to Psy.
Spend the day with Psy.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Radio Psy Thursday Live.
Continuing our musing series on awareness, Radio Psy is pleased to present once again a talk by Professor G. Venkatraman in this particular series. This is the 8th talk in the present series, and it interleaves with a companion series on the essence of the Gita. Over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sai Ram and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. I hope you recall that in my last talk in the series on awareness, I spoke to you about the PN cycle. That is to say, life must be a case of converting the gifts or the prasadam given to us by God into offerings to God or naivedyam. I mentioned during the course of my talk that the trusteeship concept is an ideal system that allows all members of society to simultaneously adopt the scheme. Today, I wish to explain what I meant. I'm sure you've all heard of trusts. We have here, for example, the Sri Satya Sai Medical Trust. This trust receives donations and utilizes the donations for running Swami's hospitals. The trust is, of course, managed by a duly nominated group of trustees. The world is full of such trusts, sometimes called foundations, and in each case, the members of the trust look after the properties and assets of the trust and manage it such that the objectives of the trust are properly and satisfactorily fulfilled. The important point is that every trustee does not ever act like an owner, but as a responsible servant, serving the public in a manner intended by the founder or the founders of the trust. The service that the trustee renders is always supposed to be selfless. You might say that you already know all this and ask, what has this got to do with society? That exactly is what I am coming to presently. By way of giving you the headlines, let me say that in this case, society is the trust, God is the founder of the trust, and as members of society, each one of us is supposed to be a trustee, acting for and on behalf of God. All this might sound very mysterious and puzzling, but if you just bear with me for a short while, your doubts would all get cleared. I think the best way of explaining the important concept I just mentioned is to discuss first a statement that Swami used to make in the old days. Often in the middle of a discourse he would say, "The proper study of mankind is man." In the past I have heard this many, many times, and frankly in the beginning it was very difficult to understand, until one day I made bold to ask Swami what this meant, and he then gave me his explanation. In brief, the idea is the following. Consider first the human body. Swami makes the following points. 1. The human body is a complex biological system made up of cells. 2. Cells make up the various organs of the body like eyes, stomach, liver, etc. 3. Many organs link together to form a system. Examples include the respiratory system, the digestive system, the circulatory system, and so on. 4. In a healthy human body, the different systems do not function arbitrarily and in a disjointed fashion. Rather, they work in perfect harmony and synergy. For example, when a person runs, the heart pumps faster and blood is circulated more rapidly to the muscles of the leg particularly. Similarly, after a heavy meal, blood circulation to the brain is reduced because more blood has to be diverted to the stomach to deal with the digestion. In fact, that's why one tends to feel a bit sleepy after a heavy meal. In short, it's a case of all for one and one for all. The cells work harmoniously through the organs and the various systems to keep the body going. And the body, for its part, takes care of the organs and the cells. It is this symbiosis that enables the body to be healthy. You might once again say that all this is old hat and that you are already familiar with it. Indeed, all of us are familiar. But have you noticed the fact that through its actions, the body is sending us a strong message as to how we ought to manage society? Are you puzzled? No need to be. Just consider this. There is, as Swami points out, a very good one-to-one correspondence between the human body and society. If the cell is the basic unit of the body, the individual human being is similarly the basic unit of society or humanity. Just as the body has organs, society too has units like schools, hospitals and so on, each of which is an entity given shape by the people associated with it or working in it and managing it. The body has systems like the respiratory system. So does society, with systems like the educational system, the financial system, and so on. The various systems of the body perform various functions. So do the various systems of society. I'm sure you get the general idea. The human body and human society have strong parallels. But then, while it is fairly common to find people healthy, these days, society is far from healthy. At least that's what I think. You might differ, but let's keep our differences aside for a minute and ask when and why a society becomes sick. The answer is simple. Society becomes sick when the organs and systems of which it is made start malfunctioning. Consider, for example, public administration. This, you would agree, is one of the vital systems that forms a part of society. Suppose the public administrative system is highly corrupt, as is often the case these days in many countries. We would then say that the system is sick. And when you have a sick system, what do you expect but a horde of problems? It sort of feel impatient and argue that all this is well known and that I am seeing nothing new. Well, that's how it might seem, but if you hold on for a minute, I would first like to remind you once again what Swami says. He says, "O man, take a good look at a healthy human body and study how it works. Understand fully its operating system and take hints from it." That exactly is what I am going to do next. And when I do that, you would realize that there is a sure cure for a society that is sick. And that cure is nothing but the trusteeship idea. So you see, that's how trusteeship enters the picture. Now that I have sort of given a hint about how I am going to connect the dots, let me proceed with the details. I shall do this by giving you first a very quick glimpse of the evolution of complexity and the emergence of systems in human society. If we go back in time to the period when man first appeared on earth, not only was he quite primitive, but in those far-off days, man also lived almost entirely by himself. If he wanted food, he had to hunt for it. If he felt thirsty, he had to go in search of water and then quench his thirst. If he wanted shelter, he had to look for a tree or a cave and take shelter there, and so on. By the way, animals still do more or less the same, free animals that is. But man, having been blessed by God with enormous intelligence, rapidly developed methods of using the gifts of nature to meet his various needs. As an important part of this process of advancing and improving his life, man learnt to come together with other human beings and form associations of various kinds. First there was the family, then the tribe, then the community, etc. and later it was followed by countries, nation states and so on. Today we have gone even further by having many international bodies, from the United Nations or UN to the World Health Organization or WHO. The point I am trying to draw attention to is the gradual growth of complexity in human society. With the growth of diversity and complexity came first the division of labor and then the organization of society into various functional sectors. In passing, I must mention that where living species are concerned, they too have gone up the ladder of complexity. What I mean is that to start with, living forms were quite elementary, just unicellular organisms. In due course, these beings became more and more complex, acquired various senses and organs, and so forth. For instance, some of the primitive living forms could not see. It was only later that creatures acquired nose, eyes, ears, etc. Coming back to complexity in human society, one thing that happened was the emergence of different sectors like the farming sector, the manufacturing sector, the trading sector, the banking sector and so on. And this precisely is where all the trouble slowly started. You see, the sectors of human society are like the different systems of the human body. However, whereas in the human body the different subsystems work in perfect harmony, in human society such harmony is often lacking because each sector works for its own advantage. Let me give an example. Some time ago, the US government, in order to please its national steel industry, hiked the customs duty on steel imported from overseas. This, of course, delighted the steel industry in America, but the automakers of America were far from happy. Already, they were facing stiff competition from automobiles imported from Japan, Korea, etc., and also autos made in America by the Japanese and Koreans. And now, thanks to the hike in import duty of steel, that is, these American companies were forced to buy local steel, that is steel made in America, which was expensive. This greatly enhanced the cost of American cars, making them even more unattractive to prospective buyers. What I am driving at is that as complexity grows, it frequently happens that the different sectors clash with each other, because each sector is driven by its own agenda and priorities. In general, the greater the complexity, the greater is the pull and push between the different sectors. People say that such tensions are inevitable since each sector would like to get the maximum advantage for itself from society. Maybe. But what happens when conflict snowballs to the point of being a threat to the whole of humanity? Whether you like it or not, we are rapidly reaching that state. More about that soon, but in the meantime, there is something else I must call attention to. I might sound like a Cassandra of doom, but many have in the past expressed their concerns about the great issues and problems facing humanity, and indeed planet Earth itself. Take, for example, the United Nations, founded in 1944, even as the Second World War was drawing to an end. Even before the atom bombs were dropped, leaders of the world were anxious that humanity must never again be exposed to the scourge of deadly wars. And with that objective in mind, they created a global institution, the UN, with, of course, much hope. But just look at what has happened since then. In short, what has happened in human history can be stated simply as follows. 1. The pressure for progress drives society towards complexity. 2. In turn, complexity generates more and more sectors, that is, it introduces diversity. 3. Each sector inevitably has its own priorities, and the priorities of different sectors often tend to clash. 4. As the number of sectors increase, the clashes become more pronounced, They even tend to get violent at times. 5. Even apex bodies like the UN, where all are supposed to come together for common good, gets caught up in conflict and rivalries between different sectors of political groups. Just to illustrate the above 5 points, let me cite the case of global warming that's very much in the news these days. I'm sure you've all heard about global warming. In brief, mankind is spewing out every year millions of tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, most of the carbon dioxide coming from the burning of what are called fossil fuels. Coal and oil form the 2 major components of fossil fuels. People no longer burn coal for cooking or heating houses as they once did, but hundreds of power stations burn coal for generating electricity, and all the carbon dioxide emitted by these power stations is thrown directly into the atmosphere. Further, there are close to 1 billion vehicles, like cars, trucks, scooters, motorcycles, auto rickshaws and so on, billion of them, and they all emit obnoxious exhaust fumes containing gases harmful to the atmosphere. This happens every single day throughout the year. Thanks to all this massive emission of fumes, the heat coming from the sun is trapped by the carbon dioxide in the atmospheric layer surrounding the earth like an onion skin. When the carbon dioxide burden of the earth's atmosphere was low, which was the case about 200-300 years ago, the heat radiated by the surface of the earth could easily escape back into space. But if this heat is trapped, as is in fact happening now, then the temperature of the planet would go up, and after that all kinds of terrible things can happen. This, by the way, is not speculation or science fiction. It is already beginning to happen, but that's a long and sad story into which I do not wish to go at present. Okay, so there is global warming, but where is the conflict? That exactly is what I am coming to now. You see, some years ago, all the leading nations met in Kyoto in Japan to discuss global warming, and they then decided that it would be most desirable to bring down the emission of carbon dioxide immediately. A protocol named the Kyoto Protocol was drafted, and all countries were asked to ratify it. Most countries did, but a few, and that included countries that contributed most to the carbon dioxide burden of the atmosphere, did not wish to. Why? Because if they had to cut down the emission of carbon dioxide, it would mean they would have to consume less oil, produce less electricity, drive fewer cars, and make new cars far more fuel efficient. They must stop selling coal also, and all those sort of things. In short, all these measures meant more expenditure and less profit for their industries, and that was not acceptable to the countries that did not like the Kyoto Protocol. So they told the world, just look at China and India. With their huge populations and stunning rates of growth, they are the ones you should be warning, not us. China and India replied, oh yeah, is that so? All these days it was you rich countries that did all the polluting. And when we are just starting, you want us to apply the brakes on development while you are deafeningly silent about your increased consumption. How about a bit of ceiling on desires on your part? That is the way China and India and also Brazil replied. So on the debate goes. I'm not trying to take sides or present a biased picture and things like that. My point is entirely different. I'm merely trying to drive home the point that at present, the different sectors of modern society almost always tend to compete with each other, and that compounds the problem. That's my point. In short, at some point, the analogy between society and a healthy human body seems to break down. Instead, we have a good comparison between a sick human body and society rather than with a healthy human body. So the question becomes, is there any way to fix the problems of society so as to make it resemble a healthy human body? Yes, of course there is. And that is exactly what Swami has been trying to tell us for years and years. He says, in effect, Listen, Bangaru, the problem with today's society is not its complexity or having many sectors. Complexity is inevitable in a large society. After all, the human body has so much complexity and diversity. But the human body is healthy. The problem with society is the unhealthy and selfish competition between the different sectors. Just look at the human body. If you have malaria and the doctor gives a bitter medicine, does the tongue say, "Yuck, this is horrible, why do I have to put up with this bitter stuff?" And does the tongue spit out the medicine? No. Or when there is severe congestion in the lungs and the doctor wants to give an injection, does the arm say, "Why should I take the prick? Let the doctor give the injection directly to the lungs." Does the arm say that? No. In the human body, the cells and the organs and the different systems as well as the subsystems may perform different functions, but they work in perfect harmony, do they not? Suppose, Bangaru, you are walking barefoot in the jungle and a thorn pierces your foot. Do the hands say, "Not my problem, let the legs deal with the problem"? No. Instead, do not the hands come to the rescue of the foot by pulling the thorn out? God has given the perfect operating system for the healthy human body. All that man has to do is to copy this wonderful system and apply it to human society. If you do it, believe me, all the problems of society you are complaining of would vanish instantly. And by the way, unlike you humans, I do not claim any copyright. The OS of the human body is there for you to copy any number of times. Go ahead. Do it. That is the essence of Swami's message. Of course, he does not quite put it that way, but I have done so in order to drive home the point. If you have followed carefully what I have just said, you would immediately realize that the OS or the operating system governing the healthy human body is based entirely on the principle underlying the trusteeship model I am advocating. Wealthy people would not say, "Let me use this wealth to make more and more money for myself." Instead, they would think of finding ways of using their wealth for common good. You might think I am talking rubbish, but let me tell you, as recently as about 100 years ago, many in America, yes, America, actually thought this way. There was, for example, Andrew Carnegie, whose family came to America from Scotland, I believe. Carnegie entered the steel business. That was the time when America was developing very fast and needed millions of tons of steel for its construction, for the auto industry and so on. Andrew Carnegie was a tough businessman and gave his competitors hell. He, of course, made tons of money, but in the end he said, "I am going to leave as much of this money as possible back to society. It was this country that enabled me to become rich, and I am now going to pay back. My children can find their own way to work hard and make money. This country offers plenty of opportunities for that." So saying, Andrew Carnegie worked hard to give away the wealth he had earned, and in the process he benefited education. The Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh owes much to Carnegie, and he also founded the famous Carnegie Hall in New York, and so on. More recently, Bill Gates, often hailed as the richest man in the world, has also been wonderfully active in giving away a lot of his wealth for worthwhile causes. Bill Gates is not only giving away, but articulates all the time about the debt we owe to society, something that Swami frequently reminds his students about. In fact, there are many such people in America, and to their eternal credit, one must say that many of them give away anonymously, which is often rare with donors, at least in this country. What I am trying to say is that the trusteeship idea is neither new nor unknown. Not so long ago, when the slogan "greed is good" was unknown, people shared far more than they care to do these days. On the other hand, these days, people are not willing even to share a bit of their time. The story is told that when Mother Teresa once went to New York to receive an award or something like that, she talked about poverty being present everywhere, including in America. One member of the audience interrupted to say, "Mother, I am sorry, but you've got it wrong. This is America, the richest country in the world. There is no poverty here. Mother is reported to have shot back. Maybe there is no poverty of money here, but I can see there is much poverty of love. You see what I mean? To get back to the mainstream, the trusteeship idea revolves almost entirely around caring and sharing. Here, every individual thinks his life is for doing God's work, using all the time the talents and wealth he has for God's work. And how, by the way, does one do God's work? By working for society. One sees God in society and then gives as much of oneself for the sake of society as possible, each according to his or her capacity. The capital required for this is not money, but the spirit of compassion, love and sacrifice. Today's media hardly bothers to narrate touching stories relating to compassion and sacrifice. But in reality, there are many, some of which we try to disseminate through S2H and so on. Having said that, there is as yet no torrent of love. If somehow that is unleashed, then the problems of humanity would be simply swept away like a huge tsunami, sweeping everything ahead of it. Only, in this case, at the end of it, there would be peace and joy everywhere, instead of misery, death and destruction. I am sorry, I do not have the time to deal with the trusteeship concept in detail, but I believe there are some articles relating to this in H2H. And maybe I have talked about it over the radio also. In any case, it is not difficult for you to figure out in detail what a society based on trusteeship would be like. In such a society, the pharma companies would not be shy of developing drugs and vaccines needed for poor people. Drugs that are available in the market would not be prohibitively expensive, and the manufacture of their less expensive generic forms would not be blocked by the so-called patent laws, which I believe are highly immoral, though they might be held to be legal by selfish societies. Education would not be a commercial commodity commanding obscene prices and available only to the very rich or those who are prepared to borrow recklessly, and so on. In short, it would be Ramarajya. Literally translated, Ramarajya means rule of Lord Rama. But what it really means is a society in which there is not merely rule of man-made laws, but moral law. I hope you understand what I mean. Now, in the West, they have a concept called utopia. I do not know what the formal definition is. Possibly it means not only peace and plenty, but also happiness. However, the important thing about Ramarajya, which, by the way, Gandhi often spoke about, is that it is the outcome of a moral basis underlying society. In Ramarajya, people would not be corrupt, not because of the law, not because they fear punishment, but because corrupt behavior would hurt God. In other words, Ramarajya would be the natural consequence of love for God and fear of sin. And when these two are there, there would automatically be a climate of morality in society. And that's what Swami often tells us by using the words, Deva Priti Papa Bhiti Sanganiti. All those things underlie the trusteeship operating system. There is one other important remark I need to make at this point. I am sure many of you would have noticed that I often harp on an important concept introduced to us by Swami in recent years, and that concerns the hierarchical relationship between the individual, society, nature and God. The individual, whom Swami refers to as Vyashti, is a part of society, and the society is referred to by Swami as Samashti. Now, society is in turn a part of nature. Swami uses the word Srishti for nature and, of course, Samashti for society. Thus, Samashti leads to Srishti. And Srishti, of course, owes its existence to God or Parameshti. Thus, you have the quartet of words Vyashti, Samashti, Srishti and Parameshti. Swami adds that man must so act that his actions do not harm society and do not go against nature. It is only such actions that would be pleasing to God. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna briefly touches upon man's cosmic origin and his cosmic nature as well as his cosmic connection, adding that it is the cosmic duty of man to maintain and preserve this cosmic linkage in all its aspects. These days, people do not care about such linkages and connections anymore. They are most self-centered and care only about themselves. They want society so that they can feed from it and prey on it. But when it comes to debt to society, it's a case of, what has society done for me? It is here that men like Andrew Carnegie and Bill Gates ought to be admired. They might not be very religious or spiritual, but believe me, their heart is in the right place and they jolly well know what their priorities ought to be. Swami frequently reminds his students that we are what we are because of society and therefore we owe a lot of debt to society. Life must thus see all of us discharging our debts to society and nature and God in appropriate ways. The trusteeship principle enables just that. When everyone lives for the others, seeing the so-called others as part of their own larger cosmic self, then differences disappear. I have mentioned earlier that man is torn between his lower self that relates him to the external world and his inner self that links him to God. If the lower self dominates and wins, then there are problems galore. The stress is on differentiation, with people tending to view themselves as being different at all possible levels. In the family, it's father against son, brother against brother, husband against wife, and so on. Amongst the tribes, it is one tribe against another. In the community, it is one sector against another. In the marketplace, it is one company against another. In politics, it is one party against another. And so on it goes. The whole of humanity trying hard to come apart at the seam in every possible way. This is not a concocted scenario, but one that is almost a reality. That's why Jeffrey Sachs said in a recent BBC Reet lecture, we are coming apart at the seams. Today, human society has more or less come to a boil. If you have seen water boiling, you would have noticed that there is a turbulent state. Bubbles form, some of them join to become a bigger bubble, but inevitably all bubbles are short-lived. Today, the different sectors, be they ethnic, religious, commercial, racial, or whatever, are trying to form bubbles of security based on narrow considerations of self-interest. This security is illusory and always short-lived. So what's the alternative? According to me, it is trusteeship. Many may shake their heads and say, listen, you are trying to make your formula seem so very simple. Don't tell me that mankind has not tried hard to solve its problems. No, I am not trying to tell you that. I am well aware of the many well-intentioned efforts made by the UN and its various bodies, the NGOs of all hues and so on. I know that in the year 2000, top leaders of the world met in New York to come up with the Millennium Declaration and all that. But then, at the end of it all such efforts inevitably come to naught. You know why? Simple. You see, most of our problems are created by the head, and it is futile to try to solve such problems using the head, which, by the way, mankind always tries to do. Alternative, let the heart be the guide. It is in the very nature of the head to seek to differentiate, and when differences are stressed, conflict is inevitable. The heart, on the other hand, sees unity underlying diversity, and when that happens, we see ourselves as a part of a whole, a cosmic whole, in fact. The individual no longer sees himself or herself as an individual. Rather, the individual sees himself or herself as a part of society, even as the cell of the body merges its individual identity for the sake of sustaining the entire body. You see, there are two important angles to letting our lives be dictated by the heart. As individuals, let us remember, though at one level, the level of the Atma, the universal soul, we are all one. At the level of the body, we are different. Each one of us owes a different responsibility to society. This is like the cell of the human body doing its job with respect to the needs of the society. For its part, the collection of humans, namely society, has an obligation to its components, namely the individuals. In today's society, which essentially has been hijacked by vested interests in almost all communities and countries, macro society exists only in name. But in practice, it caters to vested interests who manage to get their job done using lobby power. It is as a result of this that education has become a commodity. And it is as a result of this people are lured into overeating, becoming obese and so on. As for medicine, its costs are generally so high that the element of compassion has more or less vanished from the medical profession. I do not have to state all the gory details, you know them all. But in Ramaraja, things would be different because there society would care for its citizens. You know why? Because in Ramaraja, the individuals would all scrupulously follow dharma. That is why. And to show how society would care for its citizens in Ramaraja, Swami has set up a university that offers free and value-based education, hospitals that offer even tertiary care, totally free to one and all, and drinking water systems that cater to about 10 million people. Swami says that when the Lord came as Rama, the Lord not only demonstrated how individuals must sustain dharma, but the Lord as Emperor Rama also set norms for how the state must care for its people. The same two lessons, one at the micro level and the other at the macro level, are now being imparted by God in human form, in the form of our beloved Swami. And Swami is doing this all the time. In summary, thus far, man has moved forward largely on the basis of sheer worldly intelligence, at least 90% of the time. While this has enabled him to take giant leaps forward in terms of greater creature convenience, etc., it has also landed him in a huge mess. It is time to move from the era of sheer brain power and intelligence to the era of the heart. That means anchoring both individual life and social existence as a whole on basic human and spiritual values, values of a cosmic nature. And the operating system that I call trusteeship is a convenient way of doing that. I hope I have given you enough to think about until we meet again next week. Meanwhile, please do take some time off to appreciate how the trusteeship concept can really solve humanity's problems. Thank you for listening. And Jai Sai Ram.
You have been listening to a talk by Professor Venkatraman in the series Musings on Awareness. Next week's Musings talk would be on the essence of the Gita. This broadcast came to you from the studios of Radio Sai. We welcome your comments on this and all our other programs as well. Please do write to listener@radiosai.org.